I Hate Politics is a podcast dedicated to exploring a human activity we love to hate. We look at human life, culture, economics closest to us, in our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and in our local governments. Together, we'll explore how politics is central to getting things done in societies where we treasure diverse views and preferences. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. I've spent my life studying politics, and I know this. Unless we want to live in a dictatorship or a monarchy, we are stuck with politics. Politics is more than just Trump, Biden, or elections. It's how we fix potholes, make our streets safer, where we put our schools, and decide who goes to them. It's about coming together as a community. It's about us. Let's go find those stories. In this episode, we examine the expansion of food distribution networks during the pandemic. Just as the country, state, and county went into lockdown in March 2020, a group of residents, pastors, and nonprofits realized the coming need for food, especially when a family lost jobs or they couldn't go to grocery stores. I talk with three guests involved in food distribution in the county. Jackie DiCarlo, the president of Mana Food Center, which is one of the county's designated food pantries. For those who don't know, Mana was originally set up decades ago by Giant Food, the grocery store. I also talk with Oscar Alvarenga, who at his church, Epworth United Methodist, in Gaithersburg, organized a food distribution in his part of the county. There were many others like Oscar, Ben Wickner, who runs the Montgomery Village Resource Center, Karen Schilling, a retired MCPS teacher, who ran food deliveries out of her garage. Finally, I talked to our own upcountry reporter, Andrew Sondry, who volunteered at no less than five different food pantries during the pandemic. In this episode, we use original music from Bad Robot Jones, a Washington, D.C. area band of escaped androids on the run. Mixing punk, progressive, and indie rock, they play songs about assassin robots, Vulcan rituals, and the fall of galactic empires. Zach Parkman on vocals and guitar, Joey Jenkins on drums, Doogie Whitaker on bass and vocals. Doogie Whitaker also works for the Mana Food Center. Take it away, guys. Now I have a comma on here. Try to figure a way out, out of this lighthouse in my mind. In the news this week, masks are off in Montgomery County, effective Tuesday, May 18th, 5 p.m. Outdoors, no masks for anyone. Indoors, you don't have to wear a mask if you are vaccinated. But really, I don't want to be the one to try to find out if you are actually vaccinated when you are not wearing a mask. Other restrictions come off as well. Businesses can operate at 75%. No limits on the number of outdoor gatherings. And indoor gatherings are limited to 250. DC has already loosened its restrictions, and many more will come off this Monday, May 24th. Welcome to the Roaring Twenties. All we need now is the stock market not to tank, and we are headed straight to the Great Gatsby. Big news with schools. WXY Architecture and Urban Design, the firm hired by MCPS to do the boundary analysis, turned in its final report. It's a year late, but this is the pandemic year. The whole boundary analysis saga has been controversial and became a hot button issue in the school board elections in which I ran in 2020. And it was only taken over once the pandemic broke out. The report finds that MCPS could improve capacity utilization in schools, bring students closer to their homes, reducing commutes, and better balance diverse populations in schools if they redistricted about 10% of students. The firm did not recommend specific school boundary changes, and Montgomery County Board of Education members have said that they are not going to take any immediate action. Too many unknowns, said one member. And another said it will cause unpalatable conversations. If you will indulge me for just a minute on this issue, first, the truth is that Montgomery County voted overwhelmingly for at-large Board of Education candidates who supported boundary change and rejected all anti-boundary change candidates by a big margin. Yet board members find that the prospect of boundary change is unpalatable. Second, I'm not sure I needed $500,000 to find out that redistricting would help with capacity, proximity, and diversity. But contested issues in public policy are often given this data-gathering treatment, and then they lie around waiting for an opportune political moment for action to be taken. Third, a big miss in all of this is the structure of how the county manages school boundaries, which is very slowly reactive rather than keeping up with the demographic and population shifts. A new policy of iterative adjustments to balance capacity, proximity, and diversity would be the best long-term mechanism to organize this effort. Going cluster by cluster and school by school is only a Band-Aid solution. Montgomery County Executive Mark Elrich announced a 32-member School Safety and Student Well-Being Committee. Yes, 32 members of one committee. Three are students, two are teachers, the rest are school administrators, county employees from Health and Human Services, the Montgomery County Police Department, the Executive Office, and other county agencies. There are no explicitly parent representatives, though most adults on the committee should be parents as well. Michael Howe is a Republican candidate for county executive in Frederick. In a political ad, he said he didn't want Frederick to become Montgomery County North with overcrowding, congestion, traffic, and high crime. To which Delegate Kirill Resnick, who has turned into a truly world-class troll, pointed out that in 2018, violent crime rate in Frederick County was 205 for every 100,000 people, while the number for Montgomery was 165 for every 100,000 people. Worth pointing out that Mike Howe was born in Silver Spring and majored in political science. Sometimes we fail as a discipline. The primary election is now just about a year out, scheduled for June 28, 2022. In Montgomery County and even some statewide races, the primary can be more important than the general elections because the county and the state are so heavily Democratic. The real political fight isn't against Republicans, but within the Democratic Party and among Democrats with differing visions of the future. At I Hate Politics, we will not only be covering local and state and some federal races, we are planning a series of in-depth candidate interviews. Having personally been through the speed dating experience offered by candidate forums, I'm asking candidates to pick a topic that shows them off at their best, and I will interview them in depth on that subject. If you are a candidate or have a favorite candidate, please reach out at ihppod@gmail.com or on Twitter at ihppod. I'll be back with our guest for this week. Jackie DiCarlo, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here, Sonia.
MANA has been a long-standing part of food security in Montgomery County. In March 2020, when COVID hit, where were you and what did you do after that?
Well, I actually was on vacation the last week of February, early March, and didn't check my email, barely watched the news when my spouse and I got to the airport. We noticed people were wearing masks. I hadn't logged on to email again. So when I got home, I noticed that my team is starting to talk about attending this county meeting, paying attention to this press release. So I got back to find that we were activating some of our preparatory emergency response procedures. We are a member of the Community Organizations Active in Disasters, which is a Montgomery County thing that morphed into the Food Security Task Force. But anyway, what we did was get ready. We are the designated food bank of Montgomery County. So we try to have some worst case scenarios. We expected those to be acts of terrorism or hurricanes or things like that. But we were relatively prepared to put some things into place.
Can you describe what those things were?
We tried to project out 2 weeks worth. We wanted to make sure we had enough food for 2 weeks. We wanted to make sure we had enough places because as the stay-at-home order went into place, churches were closing, synagogues, temples, places that we usually distributed mm-hmm. food. So we had to identify new locations. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we had to keep our staff safe. So we procured PPE, hand sanitizer, and became very active in that food security task force.
So usually is that how much inventory you keep, 2 weeks of inventory, or do you keep more? How much do you have in your warehouse? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, well, actually, it's not usually that scientific. In general, we receive a lot of food from donations. We receive a lot of food from rescuing from grocery stores and farmers markets. Mm-hmm. And it's almost more on a weekly basis. But when we realized that we were having a public health emergency, we wanted to procure and not have any question about being able to operate for 2 weeks at a time.
So what percentage of your food historically came from food rescue, from grocery stores and farmers markets and donations? Where does the food come from?
So typically we purchase about a third of our food because we do have a program that's targeted to address childhood hunger and promote nutrition in families with children. Mm-hmm. And so we don't want to leave that up to happenstance. And then we, about another 30 or so percent, we rescue from grocery stores. So we were founded in part by Giant Food. Actually, the big box stores are really helpful to us, like Costco and Target also have great relationships with farmers markets during the season. So we get about 20% of our food from farmers markets and those kind of relationships with the ag community. And then there are food drives. So Scouts will do food drives for us. Faith-based groups will do food drives for us, the business community. So if you cobble those all together, that's how we typically get food. When it came down to the pandemic, of course, we used what was on our shelves, and then we rapidly tried to get as much as we could by purchasing, first, because we kind of had a stockpile mentality, and second, because the grocery stores were no longer able to donate their surplus to us because right. They didn't have any surplus.
What did you do?
We had to limit the offerings, obviously. So we mm-hmm. went down to the basics. Early on, we just procured as much healthy food as we could. And then as it went on, we did start to do contactless food drives with community organizations and individuals. When the summer came and the growing season, we really, with the county's help and the community foundation's help, were able to expand our farm to food bank program. And then there was early on federal action. There was some federal commodities that we were able to get, particularly produce, and a program called Farmers to Families. Typically, we only get about 5% of our food from the feds, but
it seems very uncertain on a week-to-week basis of how much food you will have, which then means that you have difficulty making commitments ahead of time. How do you do this just-in-time management?
This has gotten to be an even bigger problem for us. Before the pandemic, we shifted to a choice model. So a lot of times people think of food pantries being a prepackaged box of food or bags of food. But we had, over the past 5 years, slowly migrated and evolved our model to choice model, which we believe is better because it reduces food waste. People get what they actually want. It is more culturally appropriate. It allows folks to make choices based on their health concerns, their religious preferences. And so we have these mini markets. There's one actually in Silver Spring, and we allow people, depending on their household size, to just pick whatever they want in a market that looks like a little mini Aldi's or Whole Foods or something. So that does create some problems, because if we're getting food that's donated, and say folks really want rice, and they like Uncle Ben's rice, but someone else likes brown rice, Mahatma rice, and we only got Joe's yellow rice donated, this is a problem, because people aren't necessarily interested in that. So we have a most needed list. We ask not necessarily by brands, but by the types of food, because again, we're not just interested in giving out food. We want it to be healthy, nutritious, and appealing. So it is happenstance, but we try to categorize the types of food mm-hmm. that we want and need. We try to follow the MyPlate federal guidelines of, you know, emphasizing produce and veggies. And then we do have some reliable partners. Again, I mentioned Giant, but they are notable because they have a program for donating proteins, so frozen meats. So we know that if they're able to donate chicken and ribeye or whatever, but it changes week to week, and the amazing logistics team of Manna figures it out.
Yeah, it does seem like an amazing logistics team. That was my question. It seems like a Herculean problem to be able to predict what you will get, what people will want, and to be able to match it somehow.
This is one of the flaws in the model. It was funny. I've been at Manna 8 years ago. My first public speaking was in a church basement at a Lutheran church, and I was there asking them to do a food drive. And this very, you know, smart young person, college age, said, well, why don't I just give you money so that you can buy what you want? And I was like, they haven't given me that talking point yet, but you know, it makes good sense. And so now we do try very much so, even again, pre-pandemic, to ask for food and funds. We need food, okay. Funds, and friends, volunteers as well.
Do you think it is just better to give out money as well as to receive it?
So certainly this is something that we have talked about when it's at the national level, you know, for a guaranteed basic income, or even when folks want to give us gift cards, which they then want us to pass on. Gift cards are heartburn to accountants. It's a very bad hard yep. thing to audit. But what I will say is that one of the things that we are growing more and more focused on is building our capacity to do outreach for SNAP, or what some people used to call food stamps, because we do want to try to get people the money they need to make their own purchases. So either to supplement what we give them or instead of what we give them. And clearly buying your own food is the ideal.
So you said you did get some county help. What kind of county help do you get? What kind of state help? And you said the federal help is really small.
We get public funding from the county to run as the designated food bank. Then we also are the administrator of the Community Food Rescue Network. And this is actually a great example of our partnerships in action, because this is where we have food service providers, whether they be grocery stores or restaurants or farmers market. When they have surplus, we act as kind of a traffic cop and actually use an Uber or Lyft type technology to match that food with ourselves, of course, if we need it, but other food assistance providers. So it could be Shepherd's Table in Silver Spring. It could be Only Help or Gaithersburg Help, one of the volunteer-led organizations. And what we do also, we have volunteer food runners. We'll pick up the food and take it to the location. That is funded by the county, totally funded by the county. Most of our projects are partially funded by the government and partly funded by foundations. Individuals give us more than half of our money.
So can you give me some dollar figures about your county support and
sure.
individual support?
Government contracts and grants are about 20%. Now, our revenue last year was about $6 million because of COVID. Our expenses were not that high. They were about $4 million. This is a good buffer for the year ahead when we know giving will go down, but the need will persist.
How are you gearing up for that? For that future?
So for fiscal year 22, for us, begins in July. We are taking some of that surplus and we're continuing the initiatives that we've started that haven't really come up on this conversation yet, but we're going to continue to invest in a couple of programs that were made possible. We used to serve about 3,000 households a month, and we are planning to serve 4,000 households. So we know it's still going to be an elevated need.
Let's talk distribution.
Okay.
So beyond the matching service, I heard that COVID brought out community organizations and partnerships. Can you speak to your partners?
Definitely. So, and this is one of the things that we're able to continue to invest in the year ahead. So we just yesterday had our first quarterly meeting with partners who represent the immigrant community. So MANA has, you said at the beginning, we have a long legacy, 37 years in the community, but not all new communities know us or trust us. And we also do schedule our pickups in most cases. And so we asked for some identifying information. And when the COVID started and we had a previous administration, which was quite hostile to immigrants, there was a lot
Sure.
of fear. So what we tried to do is find some trusted messengers. So we work with groups like ESIDA, which is here in East County doing sports with young people, Identity, a long-term partner in the Hispanic community. We were pointed in the direction of a group we didn't even know of in Olney called CoHealth, the South African Community Union, I think SACU is what we call them, but they work with Southern African expatriates and immigrants. And they all became sort of promotoras for us or word of mouth marketing messengers. We paid them stipends. And that was great because a lot of those folks were out of work. So we identified people, we trained them to tell them about our services. And then they also got feedback for us on our services, on the kinds of foods we were offering or not offering. One anecdote with the Ethiopian Community Center was that basically our model was not culturally appropriate. We had feedback that said, look, you know, even if we got people to schedule, trust you, they're not going to show up on a certain day or time and request food. It's not going to happen. But if we have an event, if we have a social event and you give out some produce and such as a magnet, what would really be helpful is you gave them vouchers to Ethiopian markets so that they could spend that money. So back to your point, do we give out cash? No, but we gave out vouchers. And so that is something that we are going to try to replicate in the Asian community and some other communities where small businesses, storefronts that are owned by immigrants will get customers that use a coupon or a voucher. So that's one of the new things that we've done that was really exciting for us, and it was a partnership.
Do you identify food deserts in Montgomery County?
Yeah, so we are very fortunate in Montgomery County and MANA is an active participant to have something called the Montgomery County Food Council. And they are trying to have a fair and sustainable food system. So they work on ag issues, food security issues, food literacy issues. We do have 12 priority zip codes at MANA that we are focused on. And that is a combination of factors of what the levels of food insecurity are, what are the levels of diet-related disease. And it won't surprise you that those same, pretty much those same priority zip codes became the zip codes where the highest incidence of COVID.
Looking at the future, how do you describe the politics of food in Montgomery County?
I want folks to think about food justice as much as food security.
Okay.
So food security is, you know, where your next meal is coming from. The uncertainty of that is because in my view, we want to exist really only for those emergency situations. We don't want to be a long-term situation for an individual. Like my family, when I was a kid, we were food insecure because my parents split up. My mom had to take care of two kids. She became food insecure. And then she found her way. It's temporary. People have health setbacks. But in Montgomery County, as in many places in the United States, there is persistent inability to keep up with the cost of living. And that is related to how much people have in their pockets. So we have an advocacy task force. We ourselves pay a living wage. You know, we try to shine a light on the economic issues that that cause people to turn to us. And then, of course, we've had a race and equity journey for many years, but it continues to just sharpen as we all learn more. So I would say I wanted people to understand that sometimes there are emergencies and we will always be there to help people in emergencies, but there should not be persistent food insecurity and generational poverty. And that's what people need to look at.
What, in your view or MANA's view, is a living wage in Montgomery County?
For fiscal year 22, it's going to be $15.72. And that's what we pay our lowest paid employee.
And you believe that that's a living wage in Montgomery County?
No, that is the official living wage. It all depends on your household size. It all depends on the number of hours you work, that sort of thing. So we go with the standard. Our standards, which we've waived during COVID, but typically we use the self-sufficiency standard, which Montgomery County Department of Health and Human Services produces. And that, again, to use my mom as an example, she was a high school grad. If she was working now, she would have to make $82,000 a year to not need MANA or SNAP or housing vouchers.
You know, at $16 an hour for 2,000 hours a year, that's $32,000. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge difference between what the self-sufficiency standard of $82,000 is and $32,000 at $16. So how does an organization like MANA push for that? And what do you do?
Well, we definitely rely on the federal program. So we were talking about free and reduced meals. You know, that's through federal programming. So we join groups like the Food Research Action Center, FRAC, Maryland Hunger Solutions, and making sure that those federal programs for children are as robust as possible, for seniors are as robust as possible, and for the working poor, so that the incredible increases in SNAP that we saw during the pandemic, that needs to be the bottom line. That needs, you know, we really need to reassess what is the poverty level in the country, and we need to reassess what are the basics. And I think from the American Rescue Plan and other things from the federal administration, if they want to cut childhood poverty by 50%, those federal programs are going to be really important. So we have that as part of the solution, a just economy as part of the solution, and then that we have efficient programs that fill the role of the nonprofit sector and be that safety net.
Well, before we go, do you want to plug the donation for MANA Food?
MANAfood.org is waiting to share information about how you can donate food or funds, and as well as how you can get involved in our program as a volunteer. Or I will say, I just came this afternoon from a facilitated conversation that we do once a month called Breaking Bread. And we are trying to find solutions to these mind-boggling problems that you just laid out, Sunil. And we believe that if people come together over the power of food, with different perspectives and across lines of difference, and maybe we can create new solutions that we haven't thought of in the past. And you can find out about Breaking Bread at manafood.org as well.
Well, Jackie DiCarlo, thank you very much. Oscar Alvarenga, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thank you, Sunil. Excited to be here.
All right. So you have been at the forefront of food distribution in Montgomery County throughout the pandemic. Tell me, when and where did you start?
Well, we started at Epworth United Methodist Church in Gaithersburg. Really, we started around April. When we realized that there was folks that couldn't or shouldn't be going out to grocery shop when everything started to shut down. But we started with about six families total for the month. In May, we went up to about 20 to 25 families. By the end of May, we were serving about 100 families a week. And by June, we were serving over 200 families a week.
You started really small. How did you see that need?
Yeah, so a small group of us, the pastor and other members of the church, you know, came together and realized that one of the biggest needs normally is food, right?
Right.
When families start losing income, one thing that does not stop is hunger. Mm-hmm. And that food needs to be on the table. And when we saw that other places were starting to expand their food distribution, we have a partnership with the Lord's Table, which is the Upper Montgomery County Food Soup Kitchen. And one of the things that they noticed is that while a lot of places were starting to give food, it was a lot of canned food and some produce, but very little protein in a sense of like chicken and, mm-hmm. and meat. And that's where our church wanted to really step in and be part of how can we create a box of food for families and then also be an ongoing to these families and have partnerships.
And so you have a standard box of stuff? What is in it?
Yeah, so we have, you know, rice, we have beans, we have maseca, which is used to make tortillas. We have oil, cooking oil in all the boxes. We put fruits and vegetables in all of them. Some mm-hmm. might get apples, some might get bananas. Mm-hmm. We used to do a lot more, the county used to provide a lot more lettuce type. All boxes pretty much get cereal. All of them get a big bag of frozen chicken mm-hmm. and all the boxes get bread and dessert. The difference in the boxes comes down to the size of the family. So we're not a come and grab and go type of distribution site. We literally have a list of families. We know how many adults, how many kids are in each family, and we customize each box to that family, working with our partners to identify what families are most at need. And we will keep those families on our list and they would receive food from us every 2 weeks.
You have a list of families, you said, and you stopped at 200. Is that list bigger or 200 still?
It's still at 200. One of the things that affected us, obviously this takes a lot of financial resource and a lot of moving parts. But unfortunately, back in November, the county reduced the amount of produce that a lot of the distribution sites were getting, a lot of the partners. And because of that, we weren't able to increase our number. So we really try to make sure that our partners are giving us a list of families most at need.
Who are your partners?
Right now, we're working with three different linkages to learning, which is at Summit Hall Elementary School, Rosemont Elementary, Forest Oak Middle School. We also work with the Ana Brito Foundation, and they provide English classes and computer classes to families. The Lord's Table also is a partner of us. And then we have members throughout Gaithersburg that have some sort of affiliation with Epworth Church.
These other partners give you names of families that you add to your list?
Correct. So every week, these partners, I'm missing one. And Mujer Fuerza y Coraje, which is run by Milagro Flores. She's a great partner. So every week we change the partners. I mean, the partners are the same, but not every single partner is the same week. They provide a list to us and tell us these are the 20 people that I'm sending, or these are the 40 people that I'm sending. And then, so we have that list by Thursday, by Saturday, it's printed out. And by Sunday, we are creating these boxes for those families.
Also, it's not the same families. It's different families every week.
It can be, yeah, depending on the partner. So the partners, they realize that this family now has double income, or this family now is working, or this family is no longer with COVID symptoms. So they're able to change the list depending on the need. Now, I will also say we partner up with Cider Mill Apartments, the Safe Places. Mm-hmm. It's a tenant association, which is a partnership with GBCI, the Gaithersburg Beloved Community Initiative. Mm-hmm. We serve 42 families there a week, every Sunday. That's the same. And we also give them 30 to 50 bags of produce with those 42 boxes, customized boxes. And recently, we've partnered up with the Guru Foundation. They provide between 150 to 300 meals every Sunday that we take over to Cider Mill to make sure that folks that maybe are in line to get food, but we didn't have a box for them, they can get prepared meals.
Where does the food come from? Do you buy it? How is all that organized?
Yeah, so our main produce comes from the county. We have a gentleman named by Pat. He's the president of the Lord's Table. This guy, you talk about a hero. Nobody knows him. I mean, people know him, but you don't. He doesn't have a Facebook, an Instagram, a Twitter. He doesn't have anything on social media. Mm-hmm. But this man, from the beginning of the pandemic, mm-hmm. has been going to stores 4 to 5, maybe 6 times a week, okay, and picks up bread, dessert, apples, tomatoes. I mean, his truck has become a delivery truck, and he provides us the bread and desserts and some other produce, and also he provides items to the St. Martin's Church, which is in Gaithersburg. But this man has been working so hard. He got a grant through MANA. Mm-hmm. And has been providing some of the staples, which is the pasta, the spaghetti, the rice and beans, the tomato sauce, all the canned items.
Correct.
But every week, this gentleman is on it.
You also said something about financial resources. You need money to be able to get that. Do you buy stuff?
Yeah, so we buy all of our cereal. We buy some of the oil. We buy some of the rice, some of the beans. And we buy all the chicken that we provide every week.
So you raise the money and you go out and just go to Costco and buy it? How do you do it?
We have a partnership with a gentleman that actually works for Whole Foods. So we're able to get chicken at a wholesale price through that. Mm-hmm. He's a member of our church. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to do that. Whole Foods only sells to its employees, mm-hmm. Wholesale food. So I just can't go in there and buy it. And then Costco is one of our partners. And then
this operation, how has it evolved over time?
This was all brand new, right? How do you commit to something long-term? We were scheduled to end August of last year. Mm-hmm. And we all came together. We prayed. Patrick said, look, we will help financially. The Lord's Table will help financially. And members of the church said, let's continue doing this. So we decided to continue. And it has evolved to a well-oiled machine. We have volunteers, retired folks, people that work full-time, people that are teens, young, you know, 11-year-olds that have faithfully been showing up. People that don't come to our church have been coming to the church to be part of this. And it has just become this, like I said, well-oiled machine. We have walkie-talkies. We're outside calling in. Nobody looks like crazy, but to us, it's just a smooth classical song being played in the background. So it's just been great watching it grow, be sustained, and watching people come every single weekend and just jump in and do their part.
How long do you think you will continue doing this? How long do you think there's a need for this?
Right now, we're thinking of coming back in August to see if we're going to be able to continue this. Mm-hmm. The Lord's Table originally served meals every evening at the church. You could come in and get food there, prepared meals. Mm-hmm. They would like to start that back up. Right now they're doing lunch bags. So if that does happen, if they want to start back feeding families at the church, we also have a preschool. They're willing to work around and work with us, but there are some things as things start to open up, kids start going back to school in the fall. Obviously, our manpower is going to be less. And so we want to be respectful of the people that have been volunteering with us. So August, we're going to come back and regroup and see if we're going to continue. But that's our next date of looking. And I don't know what the county plans are also, right? Like how long they keep, they're going to thinking of keeping going. The need is going to be there. One of the things I remind folks is that hunger was there before the pandemic.
Yep.
Right. Poverty was there before the pandemic. And this has just brought it, you know, so much to people that didn't expect, right, that they were going to lose their job. And as somebody that has been at the receiving end of this, mm-hmm. you don't have to be homeless to not have a full fridge.
Sure.
Right. So the need's going to be there. I think it's going to be there. Unfortunately, for the near future, next couple of years, when the state emergencies start disappearing, when a lot of the assistance, that extra assistance start disappearing, you're going to start seeing that second wave of poverty.
That's right.
Right now, a lot of folks are being sustained with this extra help. But just because it's nice outside and the birds are singing and things are getting better and people are being vaccinated, there's a huge ripple effect that catches up eventually for those that haven't been able to have that money, that stable income. And when they do, it takes time. You have to pay down debt, and that takes a long time. So we hope that the county continues providing with the Gaithersburg Hub, the Montgomery Village Resource Center, the Equity Hub there. We hope that the county continues to support them in providing resources so they can continue being that they're big organizations.
Can you explain the Gaithersburg Hub, the Montgomery Village Equity Center? What are they?
Yeah, so the Gaithersburg Hub was created in partnership with the city of Gaithersburg. They're at Seneca Creek Church, Community Church. They have been receiving a lot of produce. They've also been receiving diapers and women's hygiene items. Also have been like a resource center if you have questions about rent, about utilities, about these other things that come up when the pandemic hit. They've been very well organized. And so that's the Gaithersburg Hub, and they're on their Gaithersburg website. Mm-hmm. The Montgomery Village Resource Center is at Lake Forest Mall. Mm-hmm. And that's run by Ben Winker.
Yeah.
And he started, literally during this pandemic outside of a church in the parking lot, mm-hmm. and now has moved into Lake Forest Mall and has done amazing things. I mean, they're feeding 500 families every 2 weeks, I think, also. Diapers, the same thing. They also have clothes for women and children that might need some clothes. And it just has been doing amazing thing, including being one of the first vaccination sites outside of a clinic. So they've partnered up. So they've been doing great work. They also plan to be doing this for a long time. They have the capacity to do it. And so I feel the county supports them in that work.
One of the questions that has been in my mind is whether a soup kitchen model is the best way to meet the needs, or is a food pantry a better way? Are there any lessons that you have from your experience that are specifically related to the distribution?
So things that come to mind is that one is, don't try to do it by yourself. Creating a team that is willing to be part of something bigger than ourselves. And that helps with all the micro things. I don't think a soup kitchen versus a pantry is really where it's at. It's both, just because people are in at different levels of need. Mm-hmm. A soup kitchen does provide a place for, you don't have to worry about cooking. You can just come in and eat your food and walk away. And it lets you also build a relationship with people, mm-hmm. and, which is something extremely needed, right? Mm-hmm. People feel lonely. People feel like it's just them. So that creates that space. A pantry is great because you can come in and get what you need and then go home and prepare something for your family. Some people are embarrassed that they are even there. One of the things I've learned, though, is that the community has embraced organizations like us to help. They really feel that we're not trying to just give them a handout, that we are trying to provide, but also encouraging them in this journey that they're going through. I think moving forward, one of the things I've learned is that we have to partner with our local farms. We have to do a better job in working with our grocery stores, that fresh items and protein like meat, any type of meat, is such an essential part of people's meals. The other thing is being culturally understanding. When we have families that we know are African families, every once in a while, somebody will get this like extra stuff that has African spices. And we make sure that those spices go to our African families because we know that that's what they use. This isn't about, embarrassing somebody or telling them, here's a jelly sandwich, right? You should be happy you have food. No, we're intentionally trying to help them in this journey that they're going through right now. So I think all those pieces are necessary as we continue going.
Well, Oscar, thank you so much. Thank you for what you do. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Sunil.
You volunteered for a number of food distribution nonprofits. I want to ask you about that experience.
Yeah, so I volunteered at 5 different food pantries and food banks in the last year. For some background, I was laid off in March of 2020 at the start of the pandemic. So I was privileged to have a little bit of time on my hands. And I went to volunteer at Germantown Help, the Up County Consolidation Hub, Capital Area Food Bank, So What Else, and the American Diversity Group.
So what did you learn?
First, most of the organizations that I volunteered for were previously working on other issues and pivoted to food distribution once the pandemic started. Clearly, many low-wage workers were laid off and the unemployment insurance system in Maryland was overwhelmed. Second, what surprised me was that you couldn't easily tell who was likely to be suffering from food insecurity. Obviously, those who are experiencing homelessness or have no income are severely impacted by this, but poverty isn't always apparent. I've delivered food to many single family homes as well as apartments. You can't always tell who's suffering, so it's important to be extra considerate of everybody.
You mentioned deliveries. Is that how most of these nonprofits work, dropping off food at people's homes?
Deliveries are one way, yeah. The other is taking a large truck of prepackaged boxes or bags of food into a low-income community and setting up a table at a previously established and advertised place so that residents can come down and pick up things at their own convenience.
So what are the relative merits, the advantages, disadvantages of each strategy?
Well, home deliveries are excellent for those who work at inconvenient hours and those who can't make it to a public distribution event that, you know, may only happen periodically in their area. Also, those with various disabilities might be unable to easily travel to a centralized location. But home deliveries are also dependent on folks reaching out to organizers directly. So they tend to skew towards folks who have personal connections or who have the resources to know where to look for assistance. Big distribution events tend to pick up lots of folks in an area who don't necessarily have those kinds of connections, either because there's some sort of a language barrier or because they lack internet access. The flip side is that public distribution events tend to be much less efficient because pantries have to prepare more than enough food for everybody who could be showing up. As a result, there's typically some food left over at the end of those events. So it's not a perfect science. And most of the places that I volunteered at have done both to maximize the number of people who can be helped and minimize the amount of food waste.
Any other big takeaways?
Yeah, the first was just that the work that these food pantries and food banks do is essential. The community leaders who turn their organizations into food pantries who ramped up their already existing distributions have been working tirelessly. So I applaud them for all of their hard work. The second big takeaway is that the face of poverty is not always what it's stereotypically perceived as. Your neighbors could be experiencing hunger and you may never even know it. So it's important that you check in on everyone in your community. Lastly, direct personal connections are invaluable and allow people to get the help that they need while feeling respected.
Good job, Andrew. Are you going to continue this volunteer work?
Absolutely. And I invite anyone who's got any amount of free time to join me.
How? Where should they find this information?
The best source of information is Montgomery County's Volunteer Center website. You can just Google Montgomery County Volunteer Center. It's what I did at the beginning. And it comes up with a really great list of organizations that you can reach out to and offer your help.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Sunil.
Usually, I draw lessons from my interviews, but this time, I feel like Jackie DiCarlo, Oscar Alvarenga, and Andrew Sondry have spoken more eloquently to the lessons of COVID food distribution than I could ever have. My thanks to all three of them for putting their heart, mind, and bodies into helping others during a particularly difficult time. I'm going to follow up this episode with others examining this year of Corona. I'm talking to doctors and nurses, teachers and students, grocery and other essential workers. I'm also reading a pile of pandemic books, and I will report back on them. That's all for this episode. We used original music from DC area band Bad Robot Jones, Zach Parkman on vocals and guitar, Doogie Whitaker on bass and vocals, and Joey Jenkins on drums. I'm very much looking forward to showcasing local talent, and especially local music students on the podcast. If you want to share your music on the show, or know someone who might want to, please email us at ihppod@gmail.com or reach out on Twitter at ihppod. I hope you will subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and your home. See you next time.